The early music show comes from Tivoli in Italy, exploring not just the many fountains there, but the music that is so associated with them. Meet the man who commissioned the gardens too, and the music he therefore inspired, all in just a moment. But we have the time now at 1 o'clock. This is Ian Skelly with a summary of the news this lunchtime. The National Association of Head Teachers has passed a vote of no confidence in the government's education policies. Earlier, union members at their annual conference in Birmingham accused the Education Secretary, Michael Gove, of being like a fanatical personal trainer. The NAHT says its members are angry about changes to exams and to the school curriculum. Mr. Gove is expected to defend the reforms when he takes part in a question and answer session at the conference later today. A five-year-old British girl who died in a pool at a hotel in Egypt has been named by her family. Chloe Johnson from Forest Hill in South London died at the Coral Sea Waterworld Hotel in the resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. The British consulate says it's working to offer every assistance possible to the family. 60 people have been injured in a crash between two commuter trains in Connecticut. Five are critically ill. The accident happened during Friday night rush hour when a train leaving New York City's Grand Central Station derailed and was hit by another train coming from the opposite direction. France has become the 14th country to legalise same-sex marriage. The controversial bill, which also legalises gay adoption, provoked hundreds of protests across the country. Opponents have planned a major demonstration for Sunday next week. The widow of the former Russian spy, Alexander Litvinenko, has said only a public inquiry can get to the truth of her husband's death. The coroner, at his inquest, has ruled that he will exclude any evidence suggesting the Kremlin was involved in his death in 2006 or that Britain could have prevented it. The final of the 58th Eurovision Song Contest will take place this evening in Sweden. An audience of around 100 million people is expected to tune in. The UK will be represented by Bonnie Tyler. Denmark is the bookies' favourite to win. And the rain will push west through northern and central areas of Britain this afternoon with hill and coastal mist. But western Scotland will see some drier, brighter and warmer spells, and elsewhere it should remain mostly dry with sunny spells and it'll feel warm. Well, that's the BBC News and the weather. It's 2.5 minutes past one. Time next on Radio 3 for the Early Music Show, presented by Catherine Bott.
Hello and welcome to a thoroughly and literally al fresco early music show. Once again, we're on our travels, and this time they've brought us to the famous and ancient Italian town of Tivoli, 20-odd miles east of Rome. Its original name was Tibur, hence through the years Tiburi, Tibori, Tiboli and Tivoli. Its inhabitants still call themselves Tiburtini. In Etruscan times, Tibur was famed for its temple of Vesta and the shrine of the Sibyl of Tibur. And after it was absorbed by those territorial Romans, it became a splendid and beautiful resort where emperors Hadrian, Maecenas and Augustus had grand villas and the poet Horace a modest one. With the fall of the Roman Empire, Tivoli became a town to fight over. The Goths destroyed it, then it became a Byzantine duchy, and in the 11th century it came under papal control. By the time of the Renaissance, popes and cardinals were vying with each other to see who could live in the grandest manner, not just in Rome, but with their country houses in Tivoli. The most magnificent villa of all, designed in part to evoke the bygone classical age, was the Villa d'Este, which was commissioned in 1549 from the architect and designer Piero Ligorio. Not a new build, it was created on the site of a confiscated Benedictine convent. The house itself was lavishly decorated with Mannerist frescoes, but that's not what I've come to gawp at today. No, we're concentrating on the stupendous gardens of the Villa d'Este and playing music associated with the man for whom they were dug, planted and crammed with water features. You're going to hear those water features crashing round my ears throughout the programme. He's been called one of the last great princes of the Italian Renaissance, but he was an aristocrat of the church too. Cardinal Ippolito II d'Este, a man who also had a hand in the careers of quite a few notable musicians, particularly so in the case of a certain Giovanni Pierluigi da Palestrina. Music for Ascension Tide, O men of Galilee, as you have seen him go, so he will return. Sung by the choir of Westminster Cathedral, directed by James O'Donnell. It's from Palestrina's Primo Libro dei Motetti of 1569, presented to Ippolito II d'Este during the second period that Palestrina was engaged by the cardinal, from 1567 to 71. Palestrina had first been employed by Ippolito in 1564 as director of the summer music at the Villa d'Este, and the relationship prospered over the next 7 years. When Palestrina worked here, much of the estate must have been very much work in progress, but the cardinal had an eye to posterity, and he would no doubt be delighted that today both house and gardens are seen as such a great treasure of the Italian Rinascimento. The gardens in particular have quite a hold on people. They're one of the most visited, well-known and acclaimed monuments in the whole country. And even on a Friday in the middle of winter, there are people wandering round everywhere, reading the beautiful captions in Italian and English and just enjoying a sunny day in these elaborately planned gardens. In 1569, the writer and scholar Uberto Foglietto wrote of these gardens, "The poem cannot depict it. The first sight does not provide a full comprehension of the matter. Only long enduring consideration of its particular parts lets admiration rise by degrees." He was a member of the Accademia degli Agevoli, the circle of cultured men who surrounded Ippolito II or had work commissioned by him, among them Palestrina, of course, the goldsmith Benvenuto Cellini, and poets Ariosto and Torquato Tasso. What made this staggeringly wealthy aristocratic cleric so desirable? Who was he? And why is the number two always added to identify him? Why is he always called Secondo? Well, briefly, Ippolito, born in 1509, was the son of Duke Alfonso d'Este and Lucrezia Borgia, who was herself daughter of Pope Alexander VI, only in Italy. Young Ippolito was always destined for the church, and at the age of just 10, he succeeded his uncle, Ippolito I, as Archbishop of Milan. At 27, the former boy bishop was sent to the French court for a spell and became so popular there that King Francois I appointed him a member of his private council. And 3 years later, in 1538, Pope Paul III made Ippolito a cardinal. Ippolito always enjoyed the support of the French king and amassed more titles and a great deal of money. He was the richest prince cardinal of his time, and he intended to use his wealth to improve his situation in life still more.
Thank you.
A joyous motet, Gaude et Letare, Rejoice and Be Merry, composed by the Spaniard Cristobal de Morales to celebrate Ippolito's appointment as cardinal. The performers were the Brabant Ensemble, directed by Stephen Rice. And from now on, as we shan't be hearing any more from the first Ippolito, I'm just going to refer to our man as Ippolito without the secondo. At the papal enclave following the death of Pope Paul III in 1549, the cardinal was named governor of Tivoli, and he had a free hand with the place. He was a cultured man, and during his time in France, he'd revelled in the intellectual and artistic climate, so he wanted first to create something as beautiful in his home country. And symbolising his close ties with France, the interior of the villa and out here in the gardens are absolutely crammed with the two symbols that he loved best to represent him. They are the eagle, symbol of the d'Este family, and the fleur-de-lis of France. So he never forgot his time there. But he also wanted to use his vast riches to stake a claim on the papacy for himself. I mean, how could Rome fail to appoint him, a man of God who also had the most exquisite taste and all of whose residences offered such refreshment to the eye and to the spirit? The only real survivor of all this efflorescence of taste and money is the Villa d'Este. Why did he build his monument here in Tivoli? Well, it was famous for the truculence and litigiousness of its people, not so good, its pleasant climate, ideal for the cardinal's delicate health, and above all, for an abundance of water and springs. Standing here in the garden, you can hear water plashing and tinkling just about everywhere. And that's all the work of the villa's inspired architect and fountain creator, Piero Ligorio. He was absolutely the man for the job, steeped in knowledge of hydraulics and possessed of a thorough knowledge of classical mythology. Every fountain in these gardens has a symbolic story to tell, and we'll look at some of them after the next music. Ippolito was no less ambitious in his musical schemes, and all the leading musicians of the day beat a path to his door. This piece is by Francesco Portinaro, who was the cardinal's maestro di cappella in the mid-1560s, in charge of 15 singers, an organist and three instrumentalists. Not the most lavish of musical establishments, especially as the musicians had to compete with the splashing of the fountains.
Thank you.
Ove Sacre Sorelle, Where Sacred Sisters, by Francesco Portinaro, performed by the Vienna Motet Choir, conducted by Bernhard Klebel. You're listening to the Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott, and I'm strolling in the Renaissance gardens of the Villa d'Este in the Italian town of Tivoli. Time for our first fountain, the Fontana di Roma, or Rometta, Little Rome. It's a microcosm of the history of Rome in a series of fountains and grottos, quite noisy fountains and very mossy grottos now, beginning from left to right. Well, the origins of Rome, where else but in the mountains near Tivoli and the life-giving waters of the river Aniene, which of course joins the Tiber eventually. And that's shown, yes, and you go round a little bit, swivelling round, you get to the Apennine Mountains, the Seven Hills of Rome, and finally the she-wolf. Behind one of the little fountains, the she-wolf is suckling Romulus and Remus. We have various signs. There's a boat with an obelisk in it. This evokes the wonders of Rome, the splendours of Rome, in a rather impressionistic sort of way. But the most important thing to remember is that you look back from the Rometta fountain along the Avenue of 100 Fountains, and there is the Tivoli fountain. Tivoli and Rome inextricably connected, not just in Ippolito's mind, but he wanted the two places to be inextricably connected in every visitor's mind because he wanted to be Pope. Imagine you can see straight through the Rometta fountain, and on a clear day, apparently, you can see Rome in the very distance, and you can just make out the dome of St. Peter's Cathedral, which is where Ippolito wanted to be. And in a straight line looking back, you see the Avenue of 100 Fountains, and there's a fountain celebrating everything that is Tivoli. You can imagine the Cardinal in his Passeggiata del Cardinale, which is a lovely little avenue, a little bit nearer the house itself, so not too far for the Cardinal to have to walk. You can imagine him taking his influential visitors on a little stroll to come to see this lower avenue. It's very romantic, and it's all designed to make people think, good heavens, he's the man for the job next time round. Obviously, the gardens can't look exactly as they did when they were first completed because they're nearly 450 years old. But it does seem likely that this particular Rometta fountain provided the setting for dramatic and musical performances and perhaps firework displays on summer nights.
Thank you.
The choir of King's College Cambridge, directed by Stephen Clebury, singing Adoramus Te Christi by Giovanni Maria Nannino, a native of Tivoli and possible student of Palestrina, who certainly sang for many years in the Papal Chapel and probably also in concerts here at the Villa d'Este. He attended the Cardinal on his diplomatic mission to France in 1562. This garden design is quite hard to explain if you can't see it. The charming guidebook labours away with phrases like planimetrical configuration and an axis orthogonal to the palace, i.e. at right angles. Apparently the aim was to create an illusionistic perspectival effect which tended towards the widening of the physical dimensions of the area. And it certainly is much smaller and narrower than I was expecting. It's very steep. So if you come in at the original entrance, you are looking up an enormous hill planted with cypresses and everything you can imagine, and the fountains, of course, to a palace that's obviously meant to strike the fear of God into you, or the fear of the cardinal, at any rate. It's so very different from the kind of lush and romantic garden that we English love to associate with Capability Brown in a later century, for example. But it is worth coming here for the prose in that guidebook alone, I have to say. I think what the author is actually trying to convey is a sense that this garden is not really about glorious views. There's only one view that counts, and that's the view towards Rome. It's more about a space which looks in on itself, offering roots within the garden to different aspects of contemplation. The avenues have names to help you, as well as the Cardinal's Walk. There's the Fishpond Terrace, and the fish ponds are still well stocked with fish. The Avenue of the Dragon, the Avenue of the Hundred Fountains, which connects the Tivoli Fountain to the Roman Fountain. And in the course of the early music show, I'm tramping the whole lot for you. Fortunately, it's the most glorious sunny winter day. And here I've come to one of the most elaborate and unusual fountains of all, and it's got a musical connection. This is the Fontana del Organo, the Fountain of the Organ, and it gets a whole page to itself in the guidebook. This fountain is a masterpiece of hydraulics because it's made a water organ. And this was built by Frenchmen, and it was originally called the Fountain of the Deluge, or the Fountain of Mother Nature. Mother Nature's statue concealed an organ made in an aeolian chamber. Here's the science bit. An airtight chamber where cascading water created air vortexes, which propelled pressured air through holes in 22 pipes. These holes opened by a water-driven paddle wheel. This was a tremendous curiosity in Ippolito's time. Probably it played madrigals for four or five voices. What joy. An Italian called Zappi was the first to describe its workings in 1572. He wrote that Pope Gregory III was so satisfied and admiring that he wanted to hear it twice and thrice again. Countless gentlemen could not believe that this organ played by itself with water, but they rather thought there was somebody inside. Well, there wasn't anybody inside, and it really was worked by water. It still is. Its heyday was really the early years of the 17th century, just after Ippolito's time, after which people started tinkering with it and installed a keyboard. And by the 18th century, sadly, it was really completely derelict, not working at all. In fact, it's a symbol of the mixed fortunes of the gardens over 400 years. Happily, they're now in the constant care of the Superintendence for Environmental and Architectural Properties in Latium, which is the region of Lazio in which the Villa d'Este resides. And what does it play now? Well, it plays, I'm happy to say, Renaissance music. Every couple of hours, a small crowd, even in winter, gathers to hear 5 minutes' worth of Renaissance dances. And it's worked by a sort of water pianola. There's a cylinder that you can see when the doors open, and I have to say that the execution reminds me a bit of when I play my pianola at home. The phrasing is a little bit lumpy and it's charmingly uneven, but it's very, very pleasing to hear, surrounded by all the sound of the fountains as well, of course. The water organ was probably of more interest than its fountain to Ippolito, inspired as it was by an ancient instrument. As a contemporary account has it, of all the arts, the cardinal was particularly interested in the cultivation of antique music, and his court musician, l'arcimusico Nicola Vicentino, was noted for his practice of the art of ancient Greek music.
Thank you.
gentle breeze that stirs both the laurel and Laura's golden hair. A madrigal, Laura che il verde lauro, dedicated to Ippolito by Nicola Vicentino. The text is from a sonnet by Petrarch, and the performers there were the Huelgas Ensemble, directed by Paul van Nevel. And mention of the laurel reminds me to mention in turn that the avenues of the garden are lined with laurel hedges, which are apparently direct heirs of the original laurels that were planted by Ippolito's gardeners. And also we have a few original trees, now very bent, but very imposing. Well, we've visited the Fountain of Rome with its very obvious worldly purpose of reminding people that it's the home of St. Peter's, the Vatican and the papacy, connected with Tivoli, of course, by water. In a more general sense, these gardens were designed to emphasise the refinement and culture of their owner. Above all, at the fountain I've come to now, described in Ippolito's time as the most important of all the fountains in this garden, and possibly all of Italy. The Fontana di Tivoli, or Fontana dell'Ovato, is a huge oval basin on several levels. Working upwards, well, there's an oval basin, and there are several fountains playing in niches, cascading down from a balustrade above it. Above the balustrade, we have a large central statue of the Sibyl of Tibur, symbol of the town, and ancient deities representing the two rivers of the town, reclining bearded and naked at her side. They're surrounded by entirely man-made cliffs, little cliffs really, just designed to give an impression of the height and the rural, mountainous, wild nature of the origins of this town. And way above the Sibyl is a beautiful statue of the winged horse Pegasus. And Pegasus is about to take off from Mount Helicon after making the blushful Hippocrene burst forth with a blow of his hooves, another mountain fertile with water to compare to the mountains round Tivoli. Oh, for a beakerful of the warm south, say I, and actually right by my side, in contrast to the huge, gushing, crashing, roaring fountains, is a delicate little gargoyle which produces acqua potabile, so I can have at least a handful of fresh spring water in a minute. Behind the statue of Pegasus is the boundary wall, behind which is the town. So this is where Tivoli really starts. And you look straight down the avenue of 100 fountains, and it just proves that all waterways lead to Rome. Just another word about the whole mythological foundation of the villa and its gardens. There are two key figures throughout. First of all, Hercules, one of the guardian deities of the region and by legend founder of the house of Este. He is twinned and compared with the chaste Hippolytus. He's the one who resisted the incestuous advances of his stepmother Phaedra. As a contemporary French writer put it, the golden apples that Hercules stole from the sleeping dragon, as one of his labours, are now Ippolito's. Mindful of this gift, he dedicates the gardens to Hercules. And the villa, which we walked round briefly before coming into the gardens, is full of representations of Hercules. The whole place is a mythical garden, a sacred grove where the Muses and Apollo can dwell again as they did on Parnassus, because Ippolito d'Este has restored the music of the waters, not half, and helped the arts to flourish again. All cultured men of the 16th century would have understood all this lofty imagery. For most people today, it's not automatic. Here's a musical example which illustrates the commonplaceness of classical knowledge, those terms of reference being so ubiquitous as to be not really worthy of comment during the Renaissance. Music by Dufay, great music too, with references to Pegasus. Minerva, may you allow the praises of a generous race. Let proclaiming fame forever increase their glory, and let its voice, Pegasus-like, run flying to every corner of the world.
Oh,
Odie Christus Natus Est, Today Christ is Born, by Palestrina, from his first book of motets of 1569, presented to Cardinal Ippolito II d'Este while in his employ. The performers, Regensburger Domspatzen, directed by Georg Ratzinger. Before it, we heard Dufay's Magnanime Gentis, performed by the Huelgas Ensemble. And for the last fountain in today's programme, we've got above us the Avenue of 100 Fountains, below us the fish ponds, and here is the Fountain of the Dragon. It's a glorious cascade. There are porpoises in the pool and four dragons all spouting water rather than fire that you'd normally expect from dragons. And this is a fountain that Ippolito didn't live to see completed. He would have liked it, I'm absolutely certain. And the other thing, sad to relate, that he didn't live to see, well, in five further papal enclaves, the Vatican just failed to elect him Pope. So he died a cardinal. In the centuries after Ippolito, the gardens and the villa did have a period of decline, but they are now most beautifully maintained again, which is wonderful to see. And it's important to stress that they didn't immediately fall into decline because his heirs, his nephews Luigi and Alessandro, followed his lead. They both continued to create aesthetic delights, and like him, they loved music. Both Luigi and Alessandro had pieces of music dedicated to them. The madrigal Se io parto, io moro e pur partir conviene by Luca Marenzio, performed by La Veneziana. Marenzio worked at the Villa d'Este not for Ippolito, but for his nephew Luigi, to whom he dedicated his first book of madrigals. That isn't actually from the first book, but I've chosen it because it has a beautiful valedictory text. If I should leave, I would die. Yet leave I must. My love then will die, and my parting part me and take my life away. That seems to sum up what Ippolito felt about these gardens. I hope he did. He ought to have done. At his death in 1572, he still hadn't become Pope, and he hadn't completed the gardens. And we mustn't forget that part of his purpose in making them was to impress upon everybody that he was the obvious candidate for for the papacy. But in doing this rather worldly thing, he happens to have created a garden of magical beauty that's still greatly loved by Italians and any visitor today.
That was Catherine Bott, and today's Early Music Show was produced by Sam Phillips. In tomorrow's programme, as part of our Wagner 200 series, Lucy Skeeping looks back at the life and the music of the original Hans Sachs and his fellow mastersingers in 17th century Germany. They were the inspiration for Wagner's opera The Mastersingers of Nuremberg. That's at the same time, just after 1 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. And there's more music by Wagner in an hour's time this afternoon when we continue our Wagner 200 celebrations. The singer Robert Lloyd is your host this week for Saturday Classics. He'll be introducing some of his favourite moments from Wagner's music dramas at 3 this afternoon here on BBC Radio 3. But now it's 2 o'clock, and this is Ian Skelly with the music for the next hour. A second chance to hear performances we broadcast live last Monday as our lunchtime concert direct from Wigmore Hall in London. As well as Wagner 200, we're in the midst of our celebrations of Britain 100 at the moment. Benjamin Britten was born 100 years ago this year, and his music features in our lunchtime concert this afternoon. It was performed by the cellist Natalie Klein, and she's going to perform one of Britten's magical solo cello suites this afternoon. Either side of that, we have Beethoven and a pair of cello sonatas, where Natalie joined forces with the pianist Alasdair Beaton. The first of those is the sonata in D major. It was written in 1815, when his deafness was forcing Beethoven to withdraw from society. And the music of this piece is certainly intimate. It's also at times full of fire and rage. It turned out to be the last piece for a solo instrument that Beethoven wrote for solo instrument and piano, even though he lived for another 10 years after he composed it. It looks forward to the dark, rocky terrain of the late quartets with their complex conception and construction. A kind of total sonata is how it's been described, an attempt to write music that was more than the sum of its individual movements. It's seen by cellists as the most technically challenging and emotionally profound cello work, except for Bach's solo cello suite, certainly pre-20th century. So here is the cellist Natalie Klein and the pianist Alasdair Beaton to play Beethoven's Fifth Cello Sonata, Opus 102, Number 2.